From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, we feature a live concert with the great jazz clarinetist Kenny DeVerne. DeVerne's joined by Howard Alden on guitar and Phil Flanagan on bass. Also today, I speak with Peter Kornbluh, co-editor of Low Intensity Warfare. This new book examines the Pentagon's growing emphasis on little undeclared wars and covert action in the Third World. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews The Talking Animals, the new album from T-Bone Burnett. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Shoot to Kill. Sidney Poitier and Tom Berenger team up to track a killer through the wilderness. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. We're proud to present a jazz concert today live from the Fresh Air studio with clarinetist Kenny DeVerne. Dan Morgenstern, the head of the Institute of Jazz Studies, has called DeVerne one of his favorite musicians. Village Voice jazz critic Gary Giddens describes DeVerne as unfailingly captivating. Kenny DeVerne plays a lot of music associated with the beginnings of jazz, but you couldn't call him a traditionalist because he's also at home playing modern jazz. This will give you a sense of his range. He made his first recording in 1954 at the age of 19 with Jack Teagarden. But just a few years ago, he recorded a series of free jazz duets with Steve Lacy. DeVerne is very popular in England. He was voted top clarinetist a few years ago in the Reader's Poll of the British Jazz Journal. And his 1985 record, The Very Thought of You, won the Music Trades Association Award as the best jazz record of the year in England. He has a new record coming out soon in America called 1 Hour Tonight on the Music Masters label. Also featured on that record are the two musicians playing with Kenny today, bassist Phil Flanagan, who's recorded with Scott Hamilton, John Bunch, and Maxine Sullivan, and guitarist Howard Alden, who's recorded with Doc Cheatham and Ruby Braff. I want to welcome all of you to Fresh Air. And Kenny, let me ask you to introduce the first tune you want to play.
Oh, fine, Terry. Nice to be here. And this is the first as far as going network live. You know, it hasn't been done in a long time. I remember remotes, but nothing like this. At any rate, the first tune is a tune that's called Love Me or Leave Me. Thank you.
the three of you sound just terrific together. How long have you been playing together?
As of today. Right now, Terry. The fourth member of this group is a drummer named Giampaolo Biaggi. But circumstances being what they were with this particular concert, we decided to go with
just the
three. Yeah, the three of us, you know. So here we are.
Well, here's what I want to do. I want to invite you to the interview table, Kenny, in a couple of minutes and talk with you about your music. Mm-hmm. But if you could play another tune for us, that would be great.
All right. This is a tune called Wrap Your Troubles in Dreams. I'm sure most of the folks out there know this one.
Beautiful. We're listening to Kenny DeVern on clarinet, along with Phil Flanagan on bass and Howard Alden on guitar. And we're going to hear more of their music performed live in the Fresh Air Studio, and also coming up, we'll feature an interview with Kenny DeVern. But before we do that, we're going to take a very short break. This is Fresh Air. featuring a live concert today with clarinetist Kenny DeVereen. Kenny, you really sound terrific. Now, I want to ask you, a lot of our listeners, I'm sure, know you from the work that you did, the group that you co-led called Soprano Summit. Now, there was a time when you played soprano saxophone and other saxophones. I think you've kind of given that up, and you're really sticking with clarinet now.
Yeah, clarinet's hard enough, Terry.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that why you gave up the other horns?
Yes. I just found that I was basically trying to do on a saxophone what I was doing on a clarinet, and really there are probably more saxophone players than clarinet players, and so I took the devil's advocate's position there, you know.
I love the tone that you have. I do find that frequently on clarinet, especially at fast tempos or in the higher register, that there's a very kind of harsh, forced sound that could come out.
And you That's have how it this... feels here.
Did you ever take lessons or anything?
Oh, yeah. I went through the usual, run of teachers, and basically they taught me everything that I didn't need to know when it came down to what it is I wanted to really play.
They wanted to teach you a legit tone.
Basically, yeah. And the best way to hear, is to listen. The best way to learn is to listen.
We did a lot of listening to records when you were growing up.
Well,
and music.
Yes, a lot of records, but at the same time, I'm of an age most of the guys were still alive, the giants. You know, I'm talking about Coleman Hawkins, Charlie Parker, Lester Young, Pee Wee Russell, Bobby Hackett. Those guys were in the mainstream at the time. In fact, they were, a little younger than I am right now. At the time, yeah. So they were really in their prime, so to speak.
The first recording you made was with Jack Teagarden.
That's right.
Did a lot of older musicians take you under their wing because you were interested in the music they were playing?
Yeah, those guys were very kind. I'm talking about people like Rex Stewart and Herman Autry, the trumpeter who used to play with Fats Waller. Sandy Williams, the trombonist. Red Allen hired me when I was 16 years old, and things like that. And not out of pity or anything. I think they just happened to like me and also didn't have to pay me as much as, let's say, the regular guys who were running around. But it was a great learning process, and I had the opportunity to be on the same bandstand as these guys and share their thoughts about, what is life like on the bandstand looking out onto the audience, you see.
Now, you never got trapped in any period. I mean, you could have, when you were coming of age, gotten really...
But I did. Oh, I did.
Earlier on, did, yeah?
Yeah, I did.
How
I
so?
Did. Well, I waved a New Orleans banner, I just said, in New York City, where a very slick form of Dixieland had been, glitzing the town. I went back to very early New Orleans players and said, this is where it's really at. You know what I'm talking about? Guys like Wooden Joe Nicholas and Albert Burbank. And they're wonderful players, and I would play these records for these guys who were basically studio Dixielanders, and sort of condescending also in the fact that they were doing it because, you could make a buck doing it. And when I played them these guys' recordings, for instance, they went, what, are you crazy? And I wasn't really. I mean, you have to play within a flavor, within a genre of anything that you do.
So after really establishing yourself as a New Orleans-style player, how'd you get out of that?
Very quickly. what did I do? Well, I just sort of evolved. I just tried to play as well as I could in any situation that I happened to be in. That's how I got out of it, basically.
But why'd you want to get out of it?
Because, I think it was crippling in the sense that it... it's like I was playing with one hand behind my back, tied behind my back. And I wasn't giving expression to what it is, what my potential was going to be, or could be, or maybe never would be, or will be.
Now, you had a real small part in The Hustler, right?
Very small. I was in the scene just before Piper Laurie cuts her throat. She's coming down in this big party scene where George C. Scott and... Paul Newman are about to take on the late Murray Hamilton, who plays he was rather a gay fellow down, and they took him on, and we're going to clean him out in pool. And we were on the original cut, we were on for about almost 30 seconds on full screen as she comes down the stairs, and there we were, all playing. Roswell Rudd was on trombone and that. Dan Terry was the leader, and he did the arrangement of the tune that we played for 3 days in a row began to dream this tune. And Billy Bauer was on banjo, the wonderful guitar player. And Bunny Shawker was the drummer, and Jack Six was on bass.
And how many seconds are you left in The Hustler?
Now, just sort of like, if you don't look, you'll never see it.
So do you rent it at home and look for yourself?
No, not at all. I don't do that kind of thing. But I think somebody told me that they've restored the original length when you go to your video shop or whatever it is. They have them there, and they kept the original print.
Tell me, you win these polls in England and your albums and stuff. Is there more jazz in England? Is there...
There's more opportunities to play jazz, Terry.
Uh-huh.
In other words, there are more pubs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's tantamount to what the nightclub used to be here, the roadside cafe. There are many of them there. That's the center of all social activity in England. And probably Germany, too, or maybe most of Europe, is that. Because they do not have all-night television, for instance, stuff like that. Midnight, it's gone.
Well, we have this tremendous luxury today of hearing you perform live. So I'm going to see if we can get you to play a little bit more. But before we do that, I want to ask you, you have a new record coming out called 1 Hour Tonight. It's going to be on the Music Masters label. Do you know when it will be out?
They're aiming for an April release. It'll be on CD, LP, and cassette.
Okay, good.
And it features Howard and Phil and Gianpaolo Biaggi on drums.
Great. Okay. Let me ask you to play some more, and we're featuring a concert today. Thank you, Kenny, for the interview.
I enjoyed this more.
And my guest today for this live performance, Kenny DeVerne on clarinet, Howard Alden on guitar, Phil Flanagan on bass, and here comes part two. And Kenny, I think you're going to play one of your own pieces, right?
Well, it's a number I wrote with Flip Phillips, in conjunction with Flip Phillips, and it's called Elsa's Dream, named after my wife.
Oh, great. Thank you. Okay, it sounded terrific. Oh, we'll have time for one more tune.
Okay. Let's catch our breath for a second here.
Boy, yeah.
It's, you know, very very unique to play this naked, as they say.
What's more naked about it than it would be at a concert?
Well, the fact is, the drum, you realize, is a great big cushion.
Oh, sure, that's a drum. Right.
You know, and...
I should explain for our listeners that we don't have a drum because we haven't tested a drum acoustically in this room yet. And we're a little suspicious that it's not going to work quite that well. So
I thought it had to do with the fee.
No, actually it didn't.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so it's acoustics.
All right. Well, I think we'd like to play a number. That's the title of the album, 1 Hour.
Yeah.
Great. This is the James P. Johnson tune?
That's right.
Okay.
If I could be with you 1 hour tonight like they say in New Jersey.
Thank you. was perfectly delightful. Thanks so much for a really extraordinary concert. Thanks to all of you. You were saying, Kenny, about playing kind of naked without the drummer. You're such great musicians. It's really just a pleasure to hear you like that. Really, thanks so much, all of you. My guests for this live concert have been clarinetist Kenny DeVerne, Phil Flanagan on bass, and Howard Alden on guitar. You can hear the three of them plus their drummer on a new album called 1 Hour Tonight, which will be released soon on the Music Masters label. Thanks again to all of you for being with us. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And on our next show, I'll speak with film director Louis Malle. His new film, Au Revoir Les Enfants, Goodbye Children, has just been nominated for an Academy Award, so I hope you can join us. Can you play us out?
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Is the United States at war right now? Peter Kornbluh says the answer's sort of, but it's a new kind of unconventional, low-level warfare. Kornbluh co-edited the new book Low Intensity Warfare about American intervention in third world conflicts. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews T-Bone Burnett's new album, The Talking Animals. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Shoot to Kill, the new thriller starring Sidney Poitier as an urban cop who joins forces with a mountain man, played by Tom Berenger. Together, the two of them track a killer through the Pacific Northwest. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. Today in Lebanon, the search continues for kidnapped Lieutenant Colonel William Higgins. Higgins was abducted yesterday near Tyre. Today, a caller claiming to represent a group called the Islamic Revolutionary Brigades claimed responsibility for the kidnapping. Jim Muir reports.
The caller said the abduction had been carried out by the Islamic Revolutionary Brigades, a group which has not been heard of before and which is generally being seen as a flag of convenience for the pro-Iranian radicals who are thought to be behind the kidnapping. The caller said that Higgins would be put on trial as an American intelligence agent, adding that he'd already been moved out of South Lebanon to Beirut and on from there to somewhere else. But the commander in the south for the Amal militia, Daoud Daoud, who's leading the militia's search for Higgins, said that he believed the colonel and his captors were still in the south. Daoud and his men have been mounting checkpoints, virtually sealing off the port of Tyre, to prevent the kidnappers from moving around. Daoud said the militia was prepared to use force if necessary to release the abducted officer. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Muir in Nicosia, Cyprus.
At the White House today, President Reagan spoke about efforts to free Higgins. Michael Richards reports.
Rescue was the word President Reagan used to describe efforts to get Marine Lieutenant Colonel William Higgins free from his captors in Lebanon. The president's comments came during a photo session at a White House budget meeting with congressional leaders.
And I have to tell you, we're doing everything we can. We're trying to find out as much as we can and to try to get him located. Certainly, we want to rescue him.
But a White House official later clarified the president's statement, saying Mr. Reagan was referring to ongoing efforts through the United Nations and various governments to get all 9 American hostages freed from Lebanon. The White House is essentially playing down any speculation about a possible U.S. military raid that may have followed the president's comments about rescuing Lieutenant Colonel Higgins. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards at the White House.
President Reagan sent his fiscal 1989 budget to Congress today. The trillion-dollar tax and spend blueprint contains the administration's smallest defense request. It also calls for higher spending in education, science, and the fight against AIDS. The budget projects a $17 billion reduction in the federal deficit over this year's estimate and contains no new taxes. House Budget Committee Chairman William Gray said the package has some better domestic priorities than in the past, but he said there are still some problems. Specifically, he criticized the cuts in housing programs. Independent counsel Lawrence Walsh has named Harvard Law professor Lawrence Tribe as special counsel to represent the independent counsel's office in the Supreme Court. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
The law providing for the judicial appointment and independent operation of special prosecutors was struck down last month by a federal appeals court panel here in Washington, D.C. The lower court ruling did not come initially in the case of the Iran-Contra special prosecutor Lawrence Walsh, but the ruling could have a damaging effect on all independent counsels, including Walsh. And so Walsh has filed a brief in the Supreme Court asking the court to hear the case this spring and to reverse the lower court ruling. Today, Walsh named to represent him in the Supreme Court noted constitutional scholar Lawrence Tribe, a Harvard Law professor who has argued many cases in the high court. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
The Soviet Union today accused the United States of going back on understandings reached at the superpower summit last year. Foreign Minister Vladimir Petrovsky said negotiations in Geneva on reducing U.S. and Soviet strategic nuclear arsenals had noticeably deteriorated. But he said he believes the outstanding difficulties can be resolved in time for the next summit planned for this spring. Stock prices fell on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 14.5 points to 1986.57. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of the new album from singer and songwriter T-Bone Burnett. In addition to being a performer, Burnett has also had a successful career producing other musicians' albums. But his latest production is his own album, The Talking Animals.
I don't know what anyone who hasn't followed T-Bone Burnett's career with something approaching neurotic fanaticism will make of his new album, The Talking Animals. As just that sort of fan myself, I hope to provide you with a context in which to hear this Texan's music. Burnett attracted national attention as part of Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder Review in 1975, and Burnett shares with him Dylan's fondness for literary loopiness and withering sarcasm. In the early 80s, Burnett made a couple of wonderful albums, Truth Decay and Trap Door, that very few people heard. He put out a terribly ambitious, hopelessly pretentious record called Proof Through the Night in 1983 that people avoided at all costs. Then he started producing other people's records full-time, albums by Los Lobos, Elvis Costello, and Marshall Crenshaw, among others. It was Burnett who worked with Roy Orbison to re-record the beautiful version of In Dreams that Dean Stockwell lip-syncs so eerily in the movie Blue Velvet. After all that producing, The Talking Animals reintroduces T-Bone Burnett as a performer.
Seems like we're being followed.
That song, called The Killer Moon, was co-written by Burnett and his four-year-old daughter Molly. It features a typical T-Bone melody, big and booming, but an unusually simple lyric. As the song proceeds, it turns into a kind of nightmare version of the classic children's book Goodnight Moon. Much of the time, Burnett likes to stuff his songs with pop literary or movie references. He bends clichés and forces them to yield new meanings. Nowhere is this style more brazen than on a song called You Could Look It Up. Even when T-Bone Burnett is invoking Fitzgerald's Daisy Buchanan and winking as he describes eyes as limpid pools and a mouth like a scarlet wound, he's up to something much more original than his language. He wants to bypass all the usual things rock songs do to comfort or compliment a listener's taste. He'd rather throw you off balance or keep you guessing about where the song is going. I think his most obvious influences in this area are Dylan and the Beatles. To me, a song like Monkey Dance sounds like a fractured version of the Beatles' Come Together, as it might have been sung by John Lennon doing a Dylan impersonation. She slides across the floor, puts her head on his shoulder. His eyes search for the door, even as it pulls her closer. She is a raging beauty. He writes, I love you truly, in lipstick on the mirror, which leaves her in a furor. There are times on this album when T-Bone Burnett goes way too far. I'm going to spare you a song with verses in English, Spanish, French, and Russian, orchestrated by Van Dyke Parks to sound like Bertolt Brecht crossed with Mantovani. Burnett has a big self-indulgent streak, but most of the time he's interesting enough to make that self-indulgence sound like a heroic gesture. It's his challenge to the rest of rock and roll to make music as emotionally extravagant, as close to the bone, as it were, as this stuff.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. The United States is not at war, but we are engaged in what the Pentagon now calls low-intensity conflict. It's a pretty recent expression coined to describe our involvement in contemporary, unconventional types of low-level warfare, in which we neither declare war nor send troops. Typically, these conflicts occur in third world countries on the verge of or just following a revolution. Peter Kornbluh is co-editor of a new book of essays called Low-Intensity Warfare. The book traces the history of low-intensity warfare and brings the issue out of the military boardrooms into the public arena. I asked Peter Kornbluth to explain the term low-intensity warfare.
It is a different kind of war, a war not defined as war, whereby the troops are unconventional forces, covert operatives, reformists, technicians, agronomists, CIA personnel, Pentagon special operations forces, people who you don't see engaging in open warfare, but are actually engaged in somewhat more under-the-table covert warfare.
So this is a low-intensity warfare that usually takes place at a time when we're theoretically at peace.
That's right. It's a type of war which the Reagan administration sees going on in all parts of the world right now. Supporting the Contras is, in their definition, a form of low-intensity warfare. That is not to say that it is low-intensity inside Nicaragua or low-intensity inside El Salvador, but for the United States, it is not the type of war that is broadcast on our television sets every night. It's not the type of war where we see U.S. troops being deployed, body bags coming home. In that definition, for the Reagan administration, it is a low-level war.
How do you think low-intensity warfare fits into the Reagan doctrine of rolling back communism?
Well, that is the pro-insurgency side of low-intensity warfare. The Reagan doctrine is a doctrine that essentially calls for across-the-board support for insurgency movements in Cambodia, Nicaragua, in Afghanistan, in Africa, etc. This has become a doctrine. It is symbolized by the debate over support for the Contras in Nicaragua, but is really in some ways 50% of what the Pentagon sees as its task now and what the Reagan administration sees as its task in fostering low-intensity wars in the Third World.
Are priorities within the military being reevaluated in the light of low-intensity conflict?
Well, they are indeed. As one proponent of low-intensity warfare recently said, when he started pushing this issue 5 years ago, there was only him and several other people. Now there are 500 or 600 Pentagon officials working on low-intensity warfare. Oliver North, before he was fired from the National Security Council, actually held the title of director of the Counterterrorism and Low-Intensity Warfare Group in the National Security Council.
One of the goals, the way I understand it, of low-intensity warfare is to represent our interests in third-world countries without having the conflict ever expand into a full-scale war, without having to send American troops to that country. Now, that sounds like a real advantage of low-intensity warfare. American troops aren't there.
Well, you know, I'm a little concerned that I might come across as an advocate of low-intensity warfare here, and I'm not. Our book is designed to show what the costs and perils of fighting these types of wars are. Vietnam is a classic case. We started with a very low-level presence, covert operations, very similar to what we're doing in Central America today. And it quickly escalated into the tragedy that we now know as Vietnam. We really need to evaluate why we are conducting these policies. Do we need to be supporting the Contras in Nicaragua? Do we need to be bolstering the government in El Salvador? What are the costs to us and the pros and cons of this? But so far, this debate over low-intensity warfare has taken place in the halls of the Pentagon. It's between traditionalists, traditionalist military strategists and kind of the new generation of low-intensity warriors in the Pentagon. It really hasn't been brought to a broad public forum, which is why we decided to do this book.
Since in countries where we're involved with low-intensity warfare, there aren't American troops, do you think that the public has been more cut off from the conflict, not as engaged in public debate about it because our family members, our friends, are not being sent off to those wars?
Well, I think that's precisely the advantage that the Reagan administration sees for waging this kind of war, is that it can avoid the tremendous debate that there would be over the open deployment of troops in any third world setting. But one of the dangers of this is, of course, is that we start low level and it escalates. We get into situations like Nicaragua where all of a sudden, you know, our honor is on the line, our commitment is on the line, and we really can't withdraw. The Middle East is a classic example of the perils and dangers. Here's a situation where we get involved in low-level conflict, using military force not in full deployment, but as a kind of psychological operation. And we come up against countries who are much different from the countries in the 50s and 60s in the Third World, countries like Iran and Iraq, which have very modern technology, which can strike quickly and cause the death of American lives. It's a much different situation now. It's going to be a much more protracted conflict. And we have seen in the Iran-Contra scandal how fighting these types of low-level wars can come back to haunt our own domestic political institutions. And this is a very important point to consider as well.
What are the other lessons you think that the Iran-Contra scandal have shown about low-intensity warfare?
One of the components of low-intensity warfare, which you see in all the Pentagon reports, is dealing with the issue of political dissent in the United States and dealing with controlling the media. One of the strategies that the Reagan administration has brought to the fore is an attempt to, a very concrete institutional attempt to manipulate the hearts and minds of the American public, not just the hearts and minds of our targets abroad. And Oliver North actively pursued this. He oversaw an office in the State Department called the Office of Public Diplomacy, which had both an above-board task of attempting to manipulate information that went to the press and a covert psychological operation being waged in the United States. This has been documented by Congress, by the documents that have come out of the Iran-Contra investigation. This is a part of low-intensity warfare, and it certainly is its scariest part vis-a-vis the concerns of the American public.
There are wars and revolutions happening around the world. Some of them are low-intensity. Some of them are full-fledged, full-scale war. But there's no fighting in our streets. There's no bombing in our neighborhoods. Is it historically typical or unusual to have the degree of conflict internationally that we're experiencing now?
I don't think it's particularly atypical because there's always been conflict, particularly in the post-war period. What is atypical is the activist, interventionist policy of the U.S. government. And the United States is, in many regions, fostering this turmoil where this turmoil might not otherwise exist. In the case of Nicaragua and the Contras would not be a force today had not the United States created them in 1981 and sent hundreds of millions of dollars to keep them going, and indeed logistically run their war up until this month when Contra aid is supposed to run out.
Let me ask you. You know, I think a lot of Americans are aware of many of the conflicts that come under the heading of low-intensity warfare, though many Americans have never heard that expression before. Do you think that having that expression, like understanding the concept and knowing the word for it, will help frame a public debate about the subject?
Well, I hope so, and that's why Michael Clare and I have decided to do this book, and hopefully the book will be used to foster that debate. Because until we get the word out, until people are informed about what the Pentagon intends to do, we can't really have an honest and full debate over where our country is going. If you take us back, 28 years now, and if we had had the debate and the knowledge in this country about what John F. Kennedy called his counterinsurgency doctrine, we might have avoided how we got into Vietnam and the loss of 50,000 American lives there. There are many, many reasons why we should conduct a full and open debate about where we are going to be going, about how to arrive at peace rather than to pursue war in the Third World.
Peter Kornbluh, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Peter Kornbluh is co-editor of Low Intensity Warfare, published by Pantheon. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, we have several stories on the search for an American taken hostage in southern Lebanon this week. And a group no one has ever heard of is claiming responsibility and also saying they will put the American lieutenant colonel on trial as a CIA agent. Also, a report on campaigning in South Texas. Now, you should know that Texas has more delegates than any other Super Tuesday state. And the key for the Democrats, at least, is South Texas, which is mainly populated by Hispanic Americans. And until this year, that group has mostly been ignored by the candidates. This year, the presidential candidates have figured out that they need those votes.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of director Roger Spotwood's new movie, Shoot to Kill. It's about a city cop tracking a killer through the high country out west. 5 years ago, Spotswood gave us Under Fire about American journalists in Nicaragua. Shoot to Kill stars a personality well known on both sides of the camera, Sidney Poitier.
20 years ago, Sidney Poitier was the most famous black movie actor since Paul Robeson. He was also something of a laughingstock. He wasn't untalented. On the contrary, he had a captivating, regal screen presence and a way of making you see two sides of him at once. The lilting, humorous side that won him an Oscar in Lilies of the Field, and the stern, dignified side he showed in one liberal, anti-prejudice movie after another. Those movies, things like Guess Who's Coming to Dinner and In the Heat of the Night, were often simple-minded and mealy-mouthed. But Poitier brought an extraordinary subtlety to them. He let you see both the emotion that seethed inside him and the powerful self-control that masked it. Above all, he conveyed an air of intense alertness and intelligence. Then his career collided with history. As the civil rights movement gave way to the angry black power movement of the late 60s, Poitier became a symbol of Uncle Tomism. He was a black cleaned up for whites to approve. And when the black power movement decided it didn't need white approval, Poitier began to look like a throwback. He continued to thrive behind the scenes, directing movies like Uptown Saturday Night and Stir Crazy, but his acting career was over, until now. Shoot to Kill is a hollow action picture with just two things going for it. It looks terrific, and it marks the return of Sidney Poitier, actor. He plays a gracefully aging FBI man on the trail of a ruthless killer, and the killer has slipped himself into a party of fishermen roughing it in the mountains of the Pacific Northwest. Their guide is Kirstie Alley, who doesn't know that a murderer lurks among her charges, and the only one who can help Poitier track the fiend is her boyfriend, John Knox, a grumpy backwoods type, played rather too grumpily by Tom Berenger.
Ain't no elevators out there, mister. No cable cars, no buses, no damn taxi cabs. So why don't you settle your ass at the motel and I'll do what I do best.
Mr. Knox, you've got one choice, and one choice only. That is to guide me into those mountains. That is the one way, the only way, you will be permitted to help your friend. You're not a vigilante. You will be acting under my authority, under my orders. Questions so far? Good.
Poitier always did have a strange way of inflecting his most heated lines. He could make them sound convincing and yet tense and phony, so that you could hear the fear behind them. And Shoot to Kill is structured so that Poitier has a chance to be both masterful and comically frightened and vulnerable. On his own turf, the big city, he's completely in command, but a whole movie full of Poitier looking grim and barking orders into walkie-talkies would bore us to death. Once he gets into the high country, with Tom Berenger scowling at him whenever he trips over a rock, Poitier can show us his gift for comedy, panting and blundering while trying to maintain his famous dignity. Poitier turns the mountain scenes into an endearing self-parody, but he can't raise the movie much beyond the level of a formula action picture. The director, Roger Spotswood, has a fleet, clear-eyed style that's beautiful to look at, and the cinematographer, Michael Chapman, makes every craggy, snowy shot glisten, but nothing can compensate for the loginess of the screenplay, which slogs blearily from one plot point to the next, dragging bland cop show witticisms behind it like so much freight. If you want to see Poitier in action, it might be worth waiting for his next movie, and this time you won't have to wait a decade or two. Little Nikita opens early next month.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll talk with writer Rita Mae Brown, the author of the classic lesbian feminist novel Ruby Fruit Jungle, as well as several bestsellers, offers her advice about writing in her new book Starting from Scratch, a different kind of writer's manual. Also, we'll see if comic Rodney Dangerfield gets any respect from our critic at large, Laurie Stone, and pedal steel guitar and banjo player Winnie Winston will be back to perform a couple of songs. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Accommodations for Fresh Air's guests while they're in Philadelphia are provided by the Four Seasons Hotel, situated on Logan Square in the heart of the city's business and cultural district. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.